Hello and welcome to The Wire Weekly, with the best stories of the week from the daily episodes of The Wire. I'm Amina Shakur, coming to you from Sin in Melbourne, Victoria. Thanks for being with us today. We're on air across Australia thanks to the Community Radio Network and the support from the Walkley Foundation. And today on the show...
Nobody's ever been able to effect a regime change from the air, and neither Israel nor the Americans would ever put their boots on the ground.
US and Israeli strikes kill Supreme Leader Ali Khamenei.
And you could feel the building tremor a bit, and you could hear these deep sonic booms, and he said, that's not normal. So that was kind of disconcerting.
We speak to an Australian traveller who is stranded in Qatar amid the conflict. And later today...
And it makes the impact stronger because people with disabilities are going to see themselves in the work more.
Australian Disability Research gets a $5 million investment from the Labor government. We'll have this and more for you over the next half hour. Last weekend, US and Israeli strikes hit multiple Iranian cities, killing Supreme Leader Ali Khamenei. Reactions are mixed. Some Iranians hope the attack could lead to a democratic change, while others mourn his death and fear instability. The international community is urging all sides to return to negotiations to prevent further escalation. 4EB's Eduardo Jordan spoke with Eyal Meiroz, senior lecturer in peace and conflict studies from University of Sydney, for more.
Well, it took time, obviously, to verify that he was indeed killed, along with many other leaders of the Iranian regime. But I thought it was a bit of an understatement in terms of how significant or meaningful his death would be for the purpose or the explicit purpose of a regime change. I think the Iranian regime and especially the Iranian Revolutionary Guard are very powerful organizations, very well organized for such a situation. And so that if indeed the explicit purpose of the whole war, if you like, or attack is to replace the regime in Iran, then I didn't think that would work. Nobody's ever been able to effect a regime change from the air, and neither Israel nor the Americans would ever put boots on the ground. So the idea that, if you like, the Iranian people on the ground would have enough power to do that was not realistic.
So could you please tell us in a nutshell or a little bit more about the events that lead up to this attack?
Well, I mean, this is going back decades. So there's three things. One is Iran has been for a long time running, if you like, a program for enrichment of uranium that can be used for nuclear weapons. It has always insisted that this program is only for civilian purposes, but the level of enrichment, which went up to 60%, is solely for military-grade weapons. There's no civilian use of uranium in that level of enrichment. And so for a long time, Israel mainly was warning that if the world doesn't want to see another nuclear power that is less reliable, if you like, than the existing ones, then something needs to be done, and has been waging a war against Iran for decades. The Americans have also been quite insistent, even though coming in and out of that debate.
So there's been mixed reactions globally and from supporters from Ali Khamenei, Iranian citizens living overseas, etc. And it's been kind of polarizing. Why is this so mixed, you think?
Well, I mean, the regime has been a very oppressive one, very dictatorial. There's millions of people in Iran that have been subjected to the human rights violations against them, but also to crippling decades of sanctions that have made, along with corruption within the regime, have made their lives very difficult. Iran is a very rich nation in terms of oil and other natural resources, but the people have been suffering for a long time, and the earlier attempts at uprising were very brutally suppressed. We saw some expressions of jubilation to the death of the supreme leader, but at the same time, Iran is a nation of over 90 million people, and so you'll find also millions of people who are supportive of the regime who are now mourning the death of the supreme leader.
The U.S. President Donald Trump mentioned the conflict could last for 4 weeks. Is this realistic, you think?
Look, I think never listen really too closely to what Trump says because he doesn't have many filters. I don't think it's clear how long it will take because we are talking about reactions and counter-reactions of the main actors being Iran, Israel, the U.S., and even the Gulf states. So nobody would know for sure how long this will take. A lot of analysts are saying days or even weeks, but you know whether it'll be days or weeks, there's so many moving parts and factors in this equation.
That was Eyal Meiruz, Senior Lecturer in Peace and Conflict Studies from the University of Sydney, speaking to 4EB's Eduardo Jordan. More than 100,000 Australians remain stranded across Middle East after US and Israeli strikes on Iran over the weekend sparked widespread airspace closures. Transit passengers in Qatar have been moved into hotels indefinitely as military action escalates, leaving travellers uncertain about when they'll be able to continue their journeys. Martin Davis is one of the Australians stuck in Doha while en route to Europe. National Radio News' Noah Saccombe spoke with Davies about the limited information they have been receiving as tensions continue to rise.
Talk me through what happened when you were at the airport and what kind of, how did you find out about what was happening outside of the airport?
So we'd been sent back because we were on the flight towards Europe, and then the announcement came that we were going into Iranian airspace, but it'd been closed. So we turned around, we went back to Doha. Arriving in Doha, it was quite clear that we weren't the only plane in this situation. You got this sense that there were just lots and lots of people. You could see because people had been on the flight with me from Sydney to wherever they were going. I was now seeing again in the airport. So they'd clearly been headed for their own destinations and now were coming back. In that regard, it began to feel a little bit chaotic. And one of the things is that there was no tannoy announcements. I think in Australia, you hear tannoy announcements everywhere, but you just didn't have any inside the airport in Doha. So there was it was a kind of chaotic. We ended up going into lots of queues where you were told that you were queuing to get a voucher to go to a hotel, only for you get halfway down the line and then there are no more hotel rooms. So you had to then resign yourself to sleeping on a very hard floor in the airport overnight. Whilst that was going on, I was talking to one of the local staff at a coffee shop at midnight, and you could feel the building tremor a bit and you could hear these deep sonic booms. And he said, "That's not normal." So that was kind of disconcerting. And then you got this sense that actually suddenly the ground staff wanted us all to be reporting, handing in our passports so that we could be matched up for a hotel. And then there was this mass movement when we were like pushed out to the outside of the airport. And one reflection, one thought I had was, thank goodness they had the FIFA World Cup here just 3 or 4 years ago, because they seemed to have the infrastructure. There was volume of hotels. Suddenly a fleet of buses arrived and everyone could get onto these buses and be bused to these hotels. We got to the hotel and again, it was chaotic and there weren't enough rooms. And then suddenly it was announced that we had to go down into the basement. Everyone got these quite alarming alarms on our phones saying, get inside, go underground where you can. And so that's what we did. We were down in the basement. We sheltered there. And you're thinking, right, we might be in this rather warm basement. It felt a little bit claustrophobic initially on going in there. Fortunately, it was bigger than I first realized. And then this announcement that actually there were hotel rooms, and in fact it was a very plush hotel that we could go to. So we piled into taxis and came across to what is a 5-star hotel, and now I'm put up in this 5-star hotel and I haven't got a clue what's coming next.
Obviously during all this you're in quite a controlled environment of fellow tourists going from place to place. Have you been able to get a sense of what life is happening outside of the airport, if like the rest of Qatar, if is life going on as usual? Have you gotten a sense of that? Have you even seen it?
The first time that we left the airport, it was still just beginning to get light. And so you really couldn't sense whether that was the norm. I'd not been to this part of the world before outside of an airport. As daylight was breaking, you sense there weren't many people around. There wasn't a lot of traffic. But again, was that just a standard Sunday morning in Doha? And in that regard, I mean, I've got a former colleague who lives here and works here. And he said, yeah, it is unusual. People are asked to stay at home. We contemplated trying to meet up, but we've definitely shelved that because there are these messages coming, do not go out. And so I think the idea is that they've got us safely in hotels. I think the concern seems to be, and this is only hearsay and just from what has happened elsewhere, for example, in Dubai, with the airport in Dubai getting struck, I think there was a concern that to get people out of the airport, should airports in this part of the world become the target. So having got us out of there, that was no longer then the problem of the airport. So we become the problem of the hotels. And then eventually it's a kind of a process that we get sifted through and we finally do have a hotel in which to stay.
That was Martin Davies speaking to National Radio News, Noah Sacombe. Canada's Prime Minister has addressed a joint sitting of Parliament in Canberra during a visit to allied nations and other middle powers. Mark Carney made headlines in January when he warned the rule-based global order was breaking down and urged middle powers not to blindly follow countries like the United States. The federal government agrees with the idea in principle, and for many people affected by the conflict in Iran, it seems as a welcome shift. National Radio News, Noah Sacombe with the story.
It was a packed house in Parliament this morning. Hundreds of public servants, journalists, political staffers, firefighters and dignitaries filled the galleries to listen to Prime Minister Carney deliver his speech. Like the address he gave at the World Economic Forum in January, it was a call to action for middle powers and stronger cooperation.
In the post-rupture world, the nations that are trusted and can work together will be quicker to the punch, more effective in their responses, and more proactive in shaping outcomes, and ultimately, those countries will be more secure and prosperous. Middle powers like Australia and Canada hold this rare convening power because others know we mean what we say, and we will match our values with our actions. And the question is now, what do we do with it?
Mr. Carney's speech was met with agreeing nods and the occasional hear, hear as he spoke. Treasurer Jim Chalmers says there is a real opportunity for collaboration between Canada and Australia.
A lot of the old certainties in the global economy are breaking down and busting up. We see that in the way supply chains have changed, the way trading relationships have changed. We're seeing that in major conflicts in Europe and now the Middle East. We can't rely on a lot of the old certainties in the global economy.
Talk of middle powers and not following the lead of historic global superpowers has raised questions over Australia's relationship with the United States. Green Senator David Shoebridge says Australia is yet to take any strong action in line with what Mr. Carney has called for.
You can see the cowardly inability of Anthony Albanese even to meet the discussion points from Prime Minister Carney. The refusal to call out an illegal war, the doubling down on AUKUS. That is proof positive that the Albanese government already recognises we're not an ally of the United States, we're a hostage to Donald Trump.
Across the parliament, the recent US-Israeli strikes on Iran have been questioned by the coalition. Shadow Minister and former SAS soldier Andrew Hastie says while he prefers a powerful US than a powerful Russia, he's sceptical of President Trump's approach.
We're going to strike Iran and then leave it up to the Iranian people to do regime change. In 4 and 5 weeks' time, what's going to be left of a functioning government? At least in Iraq and Afghanistan, you had coalition troops there to establish some sort of law and order.
This shift in rhetoric against the United States aligns with the feeling for the hundreds of thousands of travellers stuck in the Middle East since the Iranian airspace closed on Friday. For Cheryl, a US citizen caught up in the Qatari capital of Doha, she says she feels ashamed to be linked to the conflict breaking out in the Middle East.
You know, Americans have been very, very arrogant that they are the number one most important country in the world. And, you know, I've traveled ever since I was able to, and I've never really agreed with that wholeheartedly. There are a lot of people who have not traveled outside of the United States or North America, and that makes a large part of the population very naive and very ignorant to the world.
Meanwhile, Chris, an Austrian man with Lebanese and Syrian heritage, says he welcomes the shift in global politics after his family have had to face external military threats for his whole life.
The world is kind of shifting away their dependency from the US, which is good because it gives them less power to rule over everyone in different aspects of life, not just militarily. To form new alliances that make more sense. Especially Europe is now trying to make stronger connections with the countries that are surrounding it rather than going all the way overseas.
Paul O'Keefe, an Australian-American who spent over 30 years in the US, says it's going to take some time for the world to adapt.
It's interesting being Australian because we're so far away, we're out of the way. It doesn't matter what Australia says. And I think it's interesting to watch in America now how people are still feeling this, we're America, but the rest of the world is saying, whoa, whoa, whoa. You know, we need to step back a little bit. So I think it's just going to be interesting how things play out over the next probably 5 to 10 years. I think it's going to take 10 years for a new world order to settle out. But I mean, man, Trump is definitely blowing up. And I think everyone is trying to struggle a little bit to, like, what does this mean and how do we react?
That was Paul O'Keefe, one of the many travelers stranded in the Middle East, ending the report by Noah Saccombe. Australians with disability could lead the next wave of disability research, thanks to a $5 million investment by the Labor government. While the announcement is welcomed by some, others believe the amount is not enough. The Wire's Eduardo Jordan and Powered Media's Emma Myers report.
The $5 million figure is proposed to empower researchers to explore ways to strengthen safety, increase accessibility, and build more inclusive communities, following key recommendations made by the Disability Royal Commission. Jane Hargrave, a community researcher living with disability, says people with lived experience driving research can impact the types of program receiving funding, which in turn can influence which policies are passed.
I was really excited when I saw the media release come out about this big investment, about disability-led research. I think what makes it different is that it's promoting disability leadership from the beginning of the project, which I think shapes projects in a really different way, so that you're making better questions and you're setting up a better methodology right from the beginning. I've seen firsthand actually in projects how that then changes the quality of what you find out in the research, and it makes the impact stronger because people with disabilities are going to see themselves in the work more. And it helps answer some of the questions that we have about Australians with disabilities. When I look through some of the topics that the grants fund, I thought these answer some really big knowledge gaps that we have here in Australia, and it can be really helpful. I have not seen such a big investment in disability-led research ever before. I've never seen anything like this. So I hope it's a sign of trends changing. I think grants that support disability-led research give us opportunities as people with disabilities to build up skills and have access to that industry as well. It's creating opportunities and career pathways for people with disabilities in the industry. But also, like I said, I feel like I've seen firsthand how us driving research can impact what programs get funded and what policy decisions get made. And I think that's the most important thing for us.
Professor Christine Eames is an occupational therapist and research director at the University of Melbourne's Healthy Trajectories Child and Youth Disability Research Hub. She's also part of one of the teams to have received early funding via the National Disability Research Partnership.
I think this allocation of the nearly $5.5 million to the National Disability Research Partnership to distribute to really disability-focused and led research is really fantastic. It's a great opportunity to put people with disability at the heart of the research so that what is researched and the outcomes from that research really are about those that matter most to people with disability. I think I would also say that it's not a lot of money, given there are 5.5 million people with disability, and that's 1 in 5 of those people are in fact children as well. So I think if we think about that 5.5 million in the context, say, of health research, where there's nearly $6 billion allocated, it's not a lot. But what the opportunity here is to really help the community build skills in authentic partnering with people with disability in the product of the research, so that actually what is done really matters.
And how will this money help people like yourself and your research?
So we're lucky enough to be one of the teams that have been funded with the early seed funding from the National Disability Research Partnership. And so that means that we're able to do some research in collaboration with young people who are really interested in the topic that we wanted to focus on, which is what is it that we need to know and do to support young people who have behaviours of concern so that their psychological safety is really supported in the different contexts where they want to participate. That opportunity means that young people with disability and their families are driving the direction of the research about psychological safety.
And are any of the families or participants also researchers, or do you have any researchers on hand who do also have a disability?
Yes, we always get Healthy Trajectories. We always do our research in partnership with young people with disability or their family members, depending on the research project. And that research project, the Psychological Safety Project, is done in partnership with young people and with parents of young people who have disability. So yes, they are partners in the research as investigators with us. It's a really good opportunity for the community to learn from what the outcomes are of this funding model about how to really authentically engage and work together.
That was Professor Christine Imms from the University of Melbourne speaking with Powered Media's Emma Myers. The federal government has doubled the application fee for the temporary graduate visa for international students, increasing it from $2,300 to $4,600. The visa allows graduates to stay in Australia and work for up to 2 years after finishing their studies. The international education sector has criticised the change, accusing the government of using international students as a cash cow. The Wire's Patrick Dunstan spoke with Phil Honeywood from the International Education Association of Australia to discuss the sector's concerns.
This is just totally inequitable. We've got a situation in which Australia already has the world's highest non-refundable student visa application fee. Many young people finishing their current student visas in mid-March. And with no notice given, they're now going to pay, on top of the world's highest student visa fee, they're going to pay the world's highest by far post-study work right visa fee. So they came to Australia on the promise that they would be able to go and get this visa if they graduated from their Australian qualification program. And many of them have got bank loans from their Indian banks and Nepalese banks and so on. Before they came to Australia for the full tuition fee to pay for their course on the basis that they could stay in Australia after graduation for 2 years and pay back by working full-time in our economy. Now they've had the rug pulled from underneath them with no notification and they have to find $4,500.
How concerned are you and the rest of the education sector that these changes could affect Australia's competitiveness as a destination for international students?
I've just been in Hong Kong speaking at the big Asia-Pacific International Education Conference, and whether the education agents, whether it be other countries who recruit international students, they all just find it, they're in disbelief, the extent to which we've got policy after policy that's restricting international students, and that really their opinion of Australia now is that we've pulled the welcome mat from underneath international education.
You'll be meeting with Education Minister Jason Clare and Assistant Minister for International Education Julian Hill this week. What will you be asking the government to reconsider?
At the very least, the Albanese government needs to give something back to international students. And one of the arguments we've been making with the Prime Minister and with other ministers, including Minister Jason Clare and Julian Hill, is that because we've got the world's highest non-refundable student visa application fee of $2,000, which is more than double most of the other countries we compete against, then for students who just want to come and do English language only or less than 12-month programs in Australia, then they should only pay half that amount as a visa application fee. They should only pay $1,000, not $2,000. Already we've found that the English language sector, which has always been very vibrant in Australia, is now down by over 40% year on year, because if you're coming just to do English in Australia for 15 to 20 weeks, then why would you bother? You've got to pay $2,000 for a lottery ticket, an application fee that's non-refundable, you may or may not get the visa, and that $2,000 could be spent in another country learning English language much more inexpensively. So one of the asks we've got is that they should, in the May budget coming up, at the very least, put some funding back into the sector for international students' welfare by, at least for English language students, halving the student visa fee.
That was Phil Honeywood from the International Education Association of Australia, speaking to The Wire's Patrick Dunstan. And that's the end of today's show. Thanks so much for your company wherever you are in Australia. The Wire Weekly is a collaboration between community radio stations SYN in Melbourne, 2SER in Sydney, Radio 4EB in Brisbane, and contributors from all across the country, with the great support from the Walkley Foundation and Community Radio Network. We'll see you next time with the stories making headlines across your community and Indigenous radio. At the same time on your local station. Check out all of this week's stories at our website, thewire.org.au. And follow us on social media. Just search for The Wire Radio, all one word, on X or on Facebook and Instagram at The Wire Independent Current Affairs on Radio around Australia. The Wire Weekly acknowledges the traditional custodians of the Wurundjeri people of the Kulin Nations, where the program has been produced. And we pay our respects to Aboriginal elders past, present and emerging. Today, The Wire Weekly is brought to you by SYN in Melbourne, Victoria. I'm Amina Shakur. Thanks so much for your company, and we'll see you next time with many more stories on The Wire Weekly.